Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
The government's failure to properly communicate the climate crisis challenge we're facing means we may not be on track to get the behavioural change necessary to meet our 2030 emissions targets. And Professor Pete Lunn of the ESRI also says while there's evidence that we have strong appetite in this country to do our bit, we're more wary of the financial and social consequences of that change. And Professor Lunn is here in the studio now. You're very welcome. Thank you for being here. So you, people will be very familiar with you because of your work over COVID-19. I know you were very busy over that period, but you're back to the day job now and your focus is more on this stuff, on climate change, our attitude towards it. Would you say that a similar effort now is required to deal with climate change as we saw for COVID-19?
Similarly, yes, there are similarities and you're absolutely right. I mean, my team had started doing work on the behavioural change element and the public understanding element of climate change before COVID hit. And then when COVID hit, we had to redirect a lot of our effort and put all our work on climate change on hold. We're now getting back to that. And actually, you're absolutely right. I mean, the analogy to COVID is very instructive. But one of the things it's made me and my team realise, actually, is that the kind of collective action that is necessary for climate change in many ways is very much harder than the collective action that we managed to pull together so successfully to tackle COVID. And I think it's really important that we understand what the differences are and why it's harder, mm-hmm. because if we're going to tackle this, and we've got longer to do it, we've got to act quickly, but there's longer over which we can galvanise people and get them to understand it. If we don't do it, there's a problem. We've got to try and galvanise, and we've got to see what the differences are between that and COVID.
So how do we do that? Because as I said in the beginning, we're all in favour of doing something. But when the something becomes a concrete action, we go, "Ooh, not quite sure about that, if it's going to cost me money or result right. in me having to change how I live."
Right. So the big point I was trying to make yesterday at the Climate Summit is how much harder the communication problem is and that we've got to recognise that and work on it really hard and research it really hard. So here's the thing. It's not about opinions and attitudes. Our research suggests that overwhelmingly the Irish population believe in human-caused climate change and are worried about it. So in terms of opinions and attitudes, belief that something has to be done, right, they're on board. As soon as you ask them, though, about different actions that they might take and what impacts those actions would have, they're at sea. People just don't know. We don't know, right? I'll give you a really good example of this. If we were asking people to say whether things would have high, medium or low impact, different behaviours they could make in their lives over a year, and people think that using a reusable shopping bag over a year would have a bigger impact on the climate than eating a plant-based diet. Now, of course, I say of course, people don't know this, but I mean, all of the science suggests that that's very wrong. Eating a plant-based diet is one of the things that would have really quite a large impact. Using a reusable shopping bag, really good for the environment, but isn't going to have a large impact. Now, why is this so important? If we don't understand how big the impact of our behaviour is, then what we can't do, the whole thing of these collective action problems is to apportion the pain fairly, that we've all got to make sacrifices and changes in our lives for the climate because we're living beyond our environmental means. But to do that fairly, we all have to think everyone else is doing it. We all have to see everyone else doing it. We all have to feel that we're doing it together. And if we're not clear about what the big actions are, the small actions are, what things make a really big difference and make a smaller difference, it's much, much harder to have that collective yes. feel and get it right.
You see, I'm thinking about that question that you posed there about the reusable shopping bag versus the plant-based diet. I couldn't answer that. I wouldn't know which one has more of an effect on climate change.
Yes, and we had people ranking 12 different actions and, you know, to use the kind of technical term, the responses were almost at chance, which is to say, you know, you might as well have been rolling a dice. Now, that's not quite true. People were fairly aware that long-haul flights are particularly damaging and that if you cut one of those out a year, that has quite a large climate impact. So there was an effect there. There were very clear misunderstandings. People overestimated the effect, for example, of driving a hybrid car versus a petrol or diesel car. It makes a difference, but people get confused between hybrid cars and electric cars and they think it makes a bigger difference. So there are some specific things we can see. But in general, people's performance on this task was really quite poor.
So what's going on there? Why don't we know this information? Why don't we have it to hand?
Well, it's complex and really difficult. Now, in COVID, that would be true of the transmission of disease too. And we did an enormous job, particularly in the early days of the pandemic. We did an enormous job in trying to educate the public about what was causing what, how transmission happened. And the science changed as we were going along. So you remember initially, people weren't so sure about masks. And then we realised masks were more effective. Initially, people thought transmission took place more on surfaces rather rather than through the air and so on. And over time, the science was changing, but we still managed to communicate very strongly in ways that made people realize that if they did X, it had a beneficial effect. And if we all did X, that added up to a beneficial effect.
Okay, so you explain to me how this works, because we had immunologists, medics, people who were working on the front line. We had scientists on here on this programme, and we were hanging on to every single word that they were saying during COVID. We wanted to understand these really complex things. I'm not sure if we had climate scientists on this programme every morning for the first hour that people would be so interested.
Well, and that's one of the problems, because, of course, COVID was an immediate threat. Right now, climate is becoming an increasingly immediate threat.
And we can see people becoming increasingly worried about it. I'm not saying, by the way, that people are not interested. I'm not saying people are not interested, but I'm not sure if we would be clinging on to every word in the same way as we were when COVID was at its peak.
I entirely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. I think the communication challenge is harder because it's harder to get consistent attention to it. And far too many climate stories at the moment, I think anyway, are still, oh no, look how big the problem is, in the sense of, you know, the climate's deteriorating faster than we think. People are already worried. People absorb that. I mean, we get report after report after report knowing we have to do things. I think the focus needs to shift more onto solutions, and particularly, and this is why I'm talking about it yesterday at the Climate Summit and here today, particularly the public's perception and understanding. Because, as I say, opinions and attitudes are fine, and people often think that sort of, you know, social science research, behavioral research, it's all about opinions and attitudes. What we're measuring is how are people perceiving the problem and how well are they understanding it? And we were doing that during COVID really effectively as well. So when you're talking about, you know, experts coming in and explaining the science of COVID, behind all of that, we were consistently measuring what were the public understanding, what were they not understanding, what did we need to stress, what did we need to get across. We're going to have the same kind of concerted communications effort for climate as we had there. But as you say, it's a bit more of an uphill battle because it's not an immediate emergency. Mm-hmm. It's a slower burn thing.
So do you see that we accept that we need to do something, or do we just accept that there is a problem and we understand that problem?
I think that increasingly climate scientists, the government, stakeholders are waking up to the scale of the communications problem that I am describing here. I think that people who are in my business as behavioral scientists are increasingly running flags up polls about climate change and saying, if you are not careful, you are going to get a backlash because of this lack of understanding. And that's partly, again, why I'm talking about. So to give you an example of that, I think personally that at the moment, too many members of the public, and our evidence suggests this, think that the changes they need to make for climate are all economic positives and don't come with costs. Now, it is true in the long run, they are economic positives. Investing in a greener and more sustainable future does have overall economic benefits. But in the short term, we've got to bear some costs. You know, whether it's the closure of more traffic lanes, making it harder to drive around the place, whether it's not using and selling fuels that we used to use and sell in fuels, whether it's changing production practices in manufacturing, in agriculture, in other places. These changes all come with immediate costs, even if there are long-term benefits. And I think we need to be honest with people about that and have a discussion about the fair spread of that cost. Because if we don't do that and we just push them at people, there's a danger we get a backlash because people don't really understand why it's so essential.
That's a really hard conversation to have, isn't it?
Yes, and part of the reason I'm trying to get that conversation going is because I think if we don't have that honest conversation, every time we try to make a start, we're going to get bogged down in political protest. That is already happening. I mean, you know, where we're trying to put in place active travel initiatives, where we're trying to change fuel use, where we're trying to change production practices, there's quite a lot of pushback already. And I think we have to be honest with people, and we have to talk about that short-term versus long-term trade-off, and we have to talk about how we spread the change fairly and what is a fair spread. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier, but it being really important to understand how big is the impact of the changes that we're asking people to make, and why do they have the impact that they do.
Do you see in your research there's a sense that technology around climate change is developing very quickly and changing, and that we could take really big decisions? Is there a sense that people feel this? We could take big decisions around the national herd, for example, or electricity generation, just as these new methods are found to mitigate against the climate effects of the systems that we already have?
I don't have the expertise to talk about the technology of that, but I do have the expertise to talk about the psychology
of
it.
It's the perception of it.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So is there a perception that that could be true? Yes, I think there is. Is it somewhat stronger in some areas than others? Yes, because people hear a rumour of a kind of salvation technology in a particular sector or area, and it's something that some people want to cling on to.
Yeah.
My own view, from what I've seen, is that we need to be extremely careful of that, because even where it might be true that a technology comes along that kind of saves us a bit, it's only going to be for one piece of what is a large jigsaw. So the idea that it in any way diminishes the overall effort across all of those pieces that have to be put in place in order to tackle climate change, I think that's a danger, and we need to be very careful of that.
And the other danger is that we all sit back and go, oh, you know, they'll make it easier for me to retrofit my home. They'll come up with a car that is cheaper than the current electric cars that are on the market. I'll just wait until somebody else comes up with these solutions.
Yes. And again, that's that whole piece about communicating what has an impact and how much does it have an impact and what are the big things you can do. Because that's a very sensible thing for people who are uncertain to do in life generally. If you're uncertain about a decision, often the thing to do is wait. Mm-hmm. And we do that all the time. Now, when it gets really negative, we call it procrastination, right? But in fact, it's a really sensible part of our human nature, right? If you're really unsure, watch what other people are doing. Take your time, get more information, learn a bit, you know, get a feel for it. Those are very sensible things for people taking decisions under risk. But in this case, the job of the kind of communicators and the coordinators, the people pushing policy, has got to be to strategically say, right, what are the behaviours that are going to have the big impact where we can clearly communicate the benefits so people get cause and effect and an idea that if we all do this, it will have an impact. And those are the places where I think, you know, the behavioural science suggests if you get your ducks in a row, you can have some real impact.
Yeah, but it's a very big hill, mountain to climb in terms of communication, would you say?
Yes, and of course, you know, it's hardly surprising for a behavioural scientist to be sitting here saying we need to do more research in behavioural science. But I mean, I'm partly saying, look, you've got to recognise how big the public communications job is, and you've got to research it really, really thoroughly and put money into this area, because if we don't bring the public with us, right, we're just not going to do it. And that's what my reading of the evidence would suggest, that there is a real problem of perception, comprehension, people knowing what they need to do, and particularly why, and why will it be fair if we apportion it in different ways, if we spread it across society in different ways. We've got to research that problem really, really carefully.
There's been a lot of political controversy, and we touched on this without naming the controversies, but the proposed ban on turf cutting, for example, the increase in carbon tax. We don't have any political parties in this state who are in denial about climate change. And you said earlier on that the vast majority of the public accept that climate change is real and it's happening now. But our lawmakers are often the ones, aren't they, who speak out about these individual and specific measures. It's a confusing message for the voting public to receive, isn't it?
I think it can be. Yeah, I think when we're talking about individual measures and we don't put it in the broader context, you know, so if we focus only specifically on the livelihoods of people who are cutting turf and don't put it in the context of the people in the cities who are also going to have to start using their cars less and walking and cycling more, mm-hmm. and, you know, going to have to start to pay potentially to go into cities. All of this is about the perceived fairness of what we're asking people to do, that we're not picking on particular communities, that it's spread around us and that we're all involved in. I think that has to be a crucial part of the communication.
When you're talking about something like turf cutting, it's a very small community of people who cut turf and who use turf to heat their home. So they feel as though they are the focus and the target of this measure, which impacts their daily lives.
Absolutely. And if you're ever involved in any kind of collective action problem and you think you're being asked to do things yeah. that other people are not being asked to do, it undermines your effort and it causes protest. And that's exactly the kind of problem that I'm trying to raise here. That I'm saying if we cannot get it into a broader context of understanding that we're all being asked to do things and what we're all doing and that people can perceive that that's fair, whether it's what the rural community versus the urban or town cities are being asked to do, whether it's what people on low incomes versus high incomes are being asked to do, whether it's what politicians versus the rest of us are being asked to do, right? All of it has to be seen to be spread, that we are spreading the cost of the changes that are being put on. And of course, in COVID, that was straightforward because to a large extent, you know, exempting essential and frontline workers and so on and people who are vulnerable, to a large extent, we were all being asked to do the same thing. And this time we're not. We're all being asked to do different things.
But is that the key to it? Like, how do we get to that COVID acceptance point with climate change action?
If I could solve that problem, I'd probably win a Nobel Prize.
You wouldn't be here.
But what I can say is that is something that we've got to put money into researching and we've got to realise is a problem we have to solve. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, I can come up with some suggestions and ideas, as I have in this interview, about ways we can make progress. But in order to make progress on that, you have to initially realise the scale of the problem, which you've just articulated. And it is a big problem, and I think we've got a lot to do. Now, you know, I do know there's a lot in our climate action plan on communication, and that policy is being implemented, and the whole idea of having the national dialogue on climate, you know, that is there. What I'm suggesting is it is incredibly important, and how we do it is going to really matter to the success
and
of the project.
And when we do it, because there is a risk here that we will only act in the way that we need to now when it's too late.
I think there are dangers. I mean, if you look at what happened with the Yellow Vest protests in France, for example, where, you know, almost the first actions that the government's trying to take, you know, there's an immediate protest and a reaction and a watering down, and there's a problem, right? And that's because that's not being done in a way that seems fair to the people who are involved, and that's what ends up happening. And I think fairness is at the heart of this. There's an argument about climate justice that you hear all the time, and it's nearly always couched as, you know, energy costs are going to bear much more on families that are low income, and that's something we've got to redistribute. Of course, that's really important. Actually, the climate justice argument is so much broader than that. Every section of our community is going to be looking at other sections of the community and saying, look, if we're being asked to do this, what are they doing? Are they pulling their weight? Are they pulling their weight? Because if I'm going to do this, I want to know everyone else is doing it. And you'll have heard me talk during COVID about the majority of us being conditional cooperators. We'll make sacrifices for the public good, but we don't want to be the mug who's doing it when everyone else isn't.
Yes.
Right? So getting that argument across where it's different actions and different things for different communities is a much harder problem. And that's what I'm trying to highlight.
Okay. Well, Pete, thank you very much. Fascinating to talk to you. Professor Pete Lund there from the ESRI. Back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.